Oh, it's the New Books and Food Podcast.
Okay. Alan Salkin here with Brian Voltaggio, chef extraordinaire, top chef finalist, and he's going to tell us more about himself. We're at the Malibu Diner on 23rd Street in Manhattan. I've taken this great chef to one of the shittiest diners in the city. No, thanks. Thank you. And so what are you up to?
Well, we just ordered club sandwiches, so I guess we're waiting on that.
Isn't that a club? What is it about a club?
You know, I think there's layers of texture in that sandwich, which are just fantastic. I mean, obviously the crispy, toasted, hopefully toasted bread. Typically bacon, which adds that, you know, smokiness and that crispy, you know, bacon element. I mean, who doesn't love pork? And then soft turkey, lettuce. Hopefully, I mean, it's January, so tomatoes, I mean, they're going to be on there, but
yeah,
a little bounce of acidity. A little bounce of acidity, though. I mean, it's there. It has its purpose. And then, obviously, lathered in mayonnaise, which is going to be fantastic. That's why I love a club sandwich. It's like, you know, it's about texture, and I think that's what makes that sandwich so good. I think it's why we gravitate towards it. And it's a meal. Like, it's an entire meal. It's dinner.
It's a salad. There's protein.
Yes.
Crunch, which is important.
Side dishes, everything. It's between two pieces of
bread. I do feel guilty about ordering the fries, because they're going to be... I'm ordered to go, and they're going to be in a steam... They're going to steam and soften, possibly.
Yeah, but it's okay. You know, look, I mean, I love crispy fries. We all do. But if you're traveling with it, they steam a little bit and they get a little soggy. It's okay. As long as they don't dry out. As long as there's salt.
Yeah.
And there's dipping sauce. You'll be good.
We think so. Speaking of bacon, I wanted to ask you about one specific recipe in the book, mm-hmm. bacon-wrapped corn. And it's not just it's not just wrapped in a little bacon.
No, it's wrapped in a lot of bacon.
What is the deal with that? Are we too baconed out?
We are, and that's why, and I'm okay with using it in some forms. If you look in the book and you look deeper, and I don't want to get off the bacon subject here, but I use pepperoni a lot, and it's kind of my go-to replacement for bacon nowadays.
I like this.
So I use
What kind of pepperoni?
What kind of pepperoni?
Yeah.
Well, typically we make it in restaurants, but
okay.
I mean, we use typical deli pepperoni, but I mean, there's Oleo, which is down in out of Virginia. We use a lot of their products a lot in the restaurant. You know, I use it because you can grind it into ingredients and use it. I use it in a squid bolognese. I use it...
I saw that.
As like sort of this like undertone of spice and smoke. I grind it into my burger.
Really?
So I use a first cut chuck and grind pepperoni into it. And one of the great things is like... Because I love a bacon cheeseburger, but the bacon sometimes is overpowering. The crazy thing is about the bacon, it always falls off. It slips off the burger. If it's not done right, if it's not artfully put together where the cheese is melted properly, like it tends to fall off. So I don't like bacon ground in the burger. It's like too much, you know. So pepperoni is like that quick substitute, but when it works, you know, for me.
Tell me, so what do you... you didn't even answer, what are you up to?
I know.
And
I
want to talk about...
So
you got
to?
A new cookbook.
Because I love pepperoni, I love bacon, I love club sandwiches.
You've got a new cookbook.
Yes.
That's where. That's why we're meeting here. You're on a bit of a tour in the city talking about your book.
So we have a new book coming out. It's called Home. I do. It's called Home. It comes out April 7th. And this is a book that, you know, it's the one that I felt like I needed to write. You know, we wrote Bold Ink, and that was very much about my brother and I and where we were at the time and place in our restaurants. You know, this is taking food, you know, that I do in my home for occasions, because it's chaptered by holidays. Super Bowl Sunday, though, is a holiday for me. It's coming up this weekend, obviously. It's very exciting. And
I know that the Super Bowl... Oh, I guess the listeners might not know.
Yes.
Okay.
You know the Super Bowl winner?
It's coming up Sunday.
It's coming up this Sunday.
The winner should be the 49ers, but it's not going to be this year.
It's not going to be this year, no. And so it's very it's simplifying food, you know, that we do, you know, that I do in my home or in my restaurants and brought it home, and it's for occasions. It's Feast of Seven Fishes, Thanksgiving dinner, Sunday suppers, breakfast. I mean, these are the occasions as a chef that I'm able to be home and actually cook. Because if you think that I cook at home daily, then
most
you're out of your
don't.
Mind. No,
most
I mean,
don't.
And those who pretend that they do, they're lying. So, but you know, we want to. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's not that we don't want to. We want to cook at home. And so, but I also want to get people in their kitchens and using it. And that book is, what I want it to be is I want it to be a tool. And I talk a lot about that in the intro, about getting to use your kitchen and getting acclimated with it again, because not a lot of people understand how to use their kitchen. The fact that there's a lot of tools in there they overlook, I think it's important to reintroduce it. You know, it's you know, a you know, for me too, when I'm talking about, you know, gathering people and family and friends around food, I mean, it's something that's an important subject for me. at the end pages. I don't know if you flip through the end.
I didn't get to the end yet.
But there's this picture, and it's my son's dish. And what he did is he jumped up while we were shooting the book in the house, and he made these cola braised potatoes, literally like Coca-Cola braised potatoes, and he just grabbed ingredients. And he just started putting it together. Seven at the time, or six at the time, seven now. And just started grabbing them and throwing, you know, we did use Dr. Pepper, yes. and he starts cooking, and he starts, you know, I have other chefs there too because they're helping me because we have to shoot 20 dishes in one day. And then he's.
My lemon meringue pie is arriving here.
That's beautiful.
Diners in New York know how to make a lemon meringue pie.
Yes, they do. I want one of those.
You can have it. Take a bite.
I will. Don't trust me. I'm diving in there. Wow, that looks delicious. We should get one of these to go too. You don't? It's delicious.
Get your own slice of whatever. This is his wife is here with us. Your lovely bride.
So we, yes. I don't know if you could see it through the podcast, it'd be amazing. What?
No, both she and the pie are very beautiful.
Yes. So he, you know, he was inspired because we were doing all of this stuff to jump up and start cooking. And so that's, we didn't even write any text about it, but I was adamant about putting it into the book because I thought it was really, really important, you know, for me personally, because I felt like it was a sense of accomplishment, what we meant, why I meant to write this book. I mean, it was to get people excited about food, using their kitchen. And
what's the recipe?
You know, I don't know how many cooks and chefs you probably talk to that say they want to get their cookbook dirty and they want people to use it. And, you know, I want all of those, that to happen, but it literally did happen. It happened, and it's a part of the book. And so
what's the recipe with Dr. Pepper in the book?
Oh, it's ribs. So it's kimchi and Dr. Pepper braised ribs. And I, you know, bringing the pressure cooker back, I mean, it's letting people understand that's a tool that's not only essential because everybody's busy lifestyles now, it's a go-to. You like to cut things in half, or even more, even faster. I mean, you can braise short ribs in minutes now, not hours. And they're just as tasty. I mean, it's you know, obviously families don't have time to stand in front of the stove and cook for a long time, but there is one recipe that's in there that does take advantage of the time. It's a Sunday afternoon recipe, maybe. It starts on Saturday, though. It's the pork shoulder. So it's coffee barbecue pork shoulder. You marinate it in that coffee barbecue rub.
You've hit a sore point for me.
A sore point?
Yes.
What's that? Using coffee and rubs?
Using coffee, because I guarantee you, you're not using decaf.
In that particular recipe, no. You can, though.
I believe that dessert, because caffeine sensitivity is genetic. It's not.
Yes,
it's not like you're a wimp or you're not a wimp. You either will stay up all night if you have it at dinner, or you won't.
Right.
I cannot order any chocolate dessert, and I love chocolate.
Yeah.
Or coffee dessert at night because I think years ago dessert chefs were trained you have to use decaf coffee in your dessert, and that is gone. There's like this, like, oh no, we're macho chefs. Yeah, like,
no, you're right about that.
That and loud music in restaurants are my two of my
and your
big
two pet
points.
Peeves. Yeah.
Yes.
You know what? Thank you for reminding me of something like that.
I have pork shoulder for breakfast because I like food for breakfast.
Yeah, you could. I mean, it could be a brunch item. Could be a brunch item. Yeah.
But actually, I'm coffee free right now.
You see, you're saving me.
There's no problem.
She's saving me. You're absolutely right. I didn't specify those decaf. It's a good
point. Use decaf, people. You don't know your friends and family may not want it.
Yeah, or you don't want your, you know, 7-year-old running around the house banging pots and pans while you're, you know, trying to do the dishes. So, but this thing is delicious, regardless of whether it's caffeinated or not. And you know, you let it marinate overnight, and it does a couple of things. I mean, there's a smokiness that comes with it, obviously with the roasted coffee, but then also the other spices because there's smoked paprika involved, and you know, brown sugar, obviously, because, you know, southern influence, little sweet tooth barbecue thing going on. And you let it marinate, and then roast it. For about 5 hours over sauerkraut, pumpkin, or some sort of squash puree, whatever you have readily available. But pumpkin is obviously a go-to. And then apple cider. And you just let this thing roast for 5 hours. It's like melt in your mouth, beautiful. And you kind of create this side dish underneath already. So you
have
got
you
this
noticed that pork shoulder was so out of favor at one point that... But it's back, and I think the price has gone back up.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It was really cheap.
Yeah. It was you know, one of those cuts that you could actually put on the table for a large family or a group of friends and family, and you weren't, you know, crushing your wallet. But yeah, I mean, all meat's gone up. I mean, everything's cool to use. All obscure cuts are cool to use. So of course, they're more expensive. Tried buying hanger steak right now in a grocery store for less than seven. Yeah. You know, it's $10 a pound. Brisket's expensive now too. You know, it's six
undeservedly so.
No, yeah, but you can do a lot with brisket.
Sure.
You know, and brisket's beautiful. Brisket deserves. I mean, good brisket. Well, you know, can be you know, valuable even if it's more expensive, because there's also, you get a better yield out of something like that. You know, unlike steaks where you get a lot of trim.
Yes.
You know, brisket's almost 100% usable. A little bit of fat on the top, but you use that for grinding. Now,
I like a dry brisket.
You like dry brisket?
Yeah. My mom always makes it too wet.
Really?
I don't like a wet brisket.
Why?
It's a pet peeve with me and my mom.
Oh, so you don't like the sandwiches at Katz's then?
I only get, at Katz's I only get pastrami.
Yeah.
And I get it cut from the top front.
From the top, yeah.
Because I know that it's too moist in the back.
Right,
I've learned. And also, there's a dish at Junior's Cheesecake called Something Different.
Really?
Which is two potato pancakes with brisket, like, between the sandwich. Oh, it's so good.
So there's something I was introduced in the South, and this is, I know we're going way off topic.
There's no topic.
It's something that I really
wanted. What topic
wanted.
Is
that? I don't know. We're talking about food and good stuff that we love to eat. So I went to this diner near a grain mill in Southern Virginia. Have you heard about this place? It's on the Blue Ridge. It's on the Blue Ridge Mountains. It was during Lambstock. We went down there.
It's not part of that Blue Hill. Black whatever. You know, that's
Blackberry Farm.
Yeah.
Oh no, that's in Tennessee. This is in Virginia. And so there's these. It was this shepherd took me there. This guy Craig Rogers, and he's like, "Look, you gotta get these pancakes." And it's me and one of my cooks, and it was. It was pancakes with braised barbecue pork shoulder with lathered with like sweet tangy sauce and then maple syrup like over the they even didn't even hold back on the maple syrup, and I was like, this is ridiculous. And then coleslaw on the top. This is breakfast.
That sounds good for me. I like a proteiny breakfast.
That was a protein bomb though. Yeah. It was pretty amazing. So I'll never forget that one. And yep. I thought about trying to play with that, like, but I don't know if I could sell pork shoulder, at least in Maryland. I don't think that'll work, pancakes. We might give it a shot. Be kind of a cool pigs in a blanket thing idea, though. Roll the pancakes.
Who's eating at your place?
Which one?
Tell me all the places you have.
So Family Meal is our newest restaurant that we're opening now. We have we'll have four soon. So we're opening a new one in Ashburn, Virginia next week. We just opened one in Baltimore. We're going to open another one in Virginia, in Richmond. And we have one in Frederick. And that is, that's like my chef-driven answer, chef, you know, back, like, answer to the suburban pad site restaurant. You know, like, that you would find in strip malls and chain malls and stuff like that. That's where I want to put this restaurant because, you know, I feel like there's a lot of busy families that are out there and, you know, they don't, obviously there's plenty of restaurants to fill that, but you know, we're talking about chain concepts. Like, I wanted to have something that was a little bit more personal where you could feel really good about going in and getting a great meal.
I guess what I'm getting at is, are you, the first time I met you, I believe you and your brother were demoing something for Williams-Sonoma at Aspen. You were making cake in a microwave.
Yes.
In a cup.
And that still happens at Colt. Not cake in a microwave anymore. We don't do that anymore. Right? But that's off my menu. But you know, Bold is, you know, the little bit more, you know, the modern approach, place where we're very playful with our food, where we can be a little bit more experimental, where we're using, you know, hyper-local, you know, ingredients and all of those things, you know, but it's, that's where, I guess, where you get to be.
Well, what are you running
creative?
Up against? Yeah, what are you running up against in resistance in the more suburban, less adventurous diner that kind of annoys you?
Nothing.
What do you wish they would?
No, I mean, I think the great, that's what Family Meal is, though, and that's what I think is really great, is that, you know, people can come in and get really great cocktails, and a really great food experience, and still bring their kids in and be loud as shit and do whatever they want and have a good time and not feel awkward about doing it. But they don't have to. People who live in that area don't have to suffer by taking their children out and getting a crappy meal and not being able to feel really good about spending their money. And that's the goal of Family Meal. It's like, because I have a young family now, and I live in the Frederick area, and there's a lot of great restaurants, but I'm running out of them. You know what I mean? There isn't enough of them. And so we kind of created it selfishly for ourselves. you know, and it's a great spot. And so we're finding a lot of people, and it's hitting the right demographic, it's hitting the right check average. I mean, it's what people are looking for, you know, in those
areas.
What
do they want to spend? What's the check average?
Oh, it's like $25-$30 for dinner. It's very approachable and affordable. We do kids, you know, plates really well, you know, so it's not an afterthought. It's something worth
thinking
about.
What's on the kids' menu?
We do, you know, typical things. I mean, we do, obviously, fried chicken, of course.
Fried chicken or chicken fingers?
We do fried chicken and chicken fingers, so we do both.
But it's not chicken.
You have to do it. Really great grilled cheese, but we do it really well. You know, maybe not as intense as Jon Favreau did on Chef. You know, we're very into that grilled cheese, but we do a really good job with it. Really great spaghetti and meatballs.
I'm not going to say it. Hey, go on.
Really great spaghetti and meatballs, but, you know, things that are fun. But we also have, you know, like chili and things like that. It's hotcakes for kids. I mean, there's all kinds of different stuff. Well, she should might as well just tell them.
Come sit over here.
Well, she brings my kids to the restaurant a lot, so she probably knows. She knows everything. We do milkshakes for the kids and for the adults.
We have adult milkshakes.
Introduce yourself.
I'm Jennifer Altagio, Brian's wife.
Yeah, she's one who writes the menus.
I'm in charge.
Just kidding. So you said that the other cookbook you had done was with your brother.
Yeah.
I know you get asked this all the time, but if you know, do people call you Michael? Do you?
Oh yeah, all the time.
What do you? Does it bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me at all. I mean, you know, Michael. I mean, it was a great thing Michael and I doing the shows together.
Does he still give you shit about winning?
Yeah, of course.
As he should.
I still go around and tell everybody. I still go around and tell everybody that I won, though, so it works that way.
Right, a Voltaggio.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You know, but it was a great thing. I mean, you know, Michael and I, we were going around. You know, he was pursuing his career, I was pursuing mine, and, you know, even though we were on the phone a lot and we were always talking about food, we weren't as connected as we were now. Top Chef kind of brought us
That's
together,
funny. Yeah.
You know? Because you
My brother think, and I are like that, too.
Yeah.
It's like he's
doing his thing, you're doing your thing.
Yeah.
Well, now we have this common thing, and sometimes we're forced to put food together. I mean, we're working on projects together. We're working on a restaurant with MGM in D.C. So it's going to be our first collaborative restaurant. It's hopefully going to open in 17, not beforehand.
Do you and the other, like, Jose Andres, the other D.C. chefs, I don't know if you call Spike Mendelsohn a D.C. chef.
Yeah, of course, he's a buddy. Yeah.
You ever, like, is there, like, a once-a-week, like, high tribunal meeting of the D.C. chefs?
No.
Yeah.
There used to be.
There
used to be an old club, you know, D.C. Chefs Club, and they still kind of get together. This is, you know, Roberto Donna, you know, Jeff Boobin, Todd Gray from Equinox, and
Wiedemeyer.
Yes, it was Michelle. It was really started with Jean-Louis. Like, it's kind of where the group started. They used to get together and they used to play, you know, poker and stuff like that. And the deal was to not talk about restaurants. That guard has kind of changed. I mean, all those chefs are still there. A lot of them are, but they're not getting together as much as they used to. I would say it's, you know, even though in New York, I mean, from what I remember, there's groups of chefs that would hang out. It wasn't like obviously it's too big to have an entire community, you know, maybe a neighborhood. In D.C., we used to have that, but D.C.'s also grown a lot. So
the traffic is horrible.
It's horrible. It's the worst. It used to take, you know, from Capitol Hill to one of my restaurants now, Range, which is this upper northwest. I mean, it used to take 20 minutes. I mean, now it takes, 40 sometimes. So it's definitely changed.
Are you still sort of on, like, the circuit, the festivals?
No, I've gotten off that. I mean, I didn't really get on it either. you know, I do some festivals, I mean, some events. You know, I work with one charity, though. I work with Share Strength, Nuke and Hungry. Made a huge impact. I've raised almost $1 million for Maryland area. I've actually helped change legislation. Actually, my son did. It wasn't even me.
How so?
One day we went to the State House, and we're in there to pass a bill that was going to ensure that about $500,000 would go towards the breakfast meal program. And it was in Maryland. It was on the brink of losing. And so we went in and we were canvassing the hallways, but we took a break and all the legislators went back to their offices. And my son was kind of fidgety, and so one of the organizers grabbed him and said, "Hey, let's get on the hallway." But she also took the informational sheet. You know, the sort of bullet points you take to a legislator, like, "Here, read this and, you know, let's make it happen." He walked in the office and demanded they read it. This is my 5-year-old child at the time.
Well, the story was...
Walks in.
She said that they were walking down the hall, and he was like, let's go in and see this guy. And she's like, okay.
Yeah.
So he knocked on the door, and he's like, excuse me, you need to read this.
Yeah.
And then he did it to every single person down the hallway.
Yeah, so here, I didn't even know that was going on. Here I go, and I give great testimony. I thought I was like, I nail this thing. And they pass it. Meanwhile, Derry had their vote in her head. I mean, they're in their office before you even came out of the chamber to go in to vote. My son did it. I was just white noise. You know what I mean? I didn't really.
And he didn't pour Dr. Pepper on them.
No. And then, you know, so he was actually the hero. And I didn't really learn this until I was actually honored at this dinner, you know, for the work that we've done. And that's where I first heard the story. I wouldn't even told that day.
I didn't know it either. Yeah.
So how have you raised most of the money? What's been the?
We do dinners at the restaurants. And I do a lot of, like, I go into people's homes. We have this menu called Table 21 at Cole, and it's a 21-course menu. It's kind of like you wrap around the kitchen, and you're seated in there. And I take that to people's home, which is a big deal. Like, we have to rent a van and load all the plates and glassware. We kind of go in, take over their kitchen, and then leave it just as it was when we walked in. And it's a pretty
good
experience.
For 10 people. So they bid on it for 10 people.
These dinners go for like, you know, $10,000 to $20,000. So I've done a lot of them, and you know, also the proceeds that we get from the dinners, you know, which are huge amounts. Of, you know, we raise a lot of money doing the dinners. And,
you donate everything that night, except for what it costs you to.
Yeah, basically just the food costs.
Yeah.
Ferran, Adrian, Jose once came to my apartment and cooked me lunch.
Did they really?
Yeah, it's for when I was at the New York Times. And Ferran, yeah, but it's a great story that ultimately it was set up weeks and weeks, like 6 months in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, you can come this certain day in September.
Right.
And I didn't know that much about the food business. I didn't know who Jose Andres was.
Right.
I didn't even know he was coming. It was Ferran.
Right.
And about a week out, I look at the calendar. Because I had this idea. Well, you want me to write about it?
Yeah.
How about he comes to my apartment, cooks me lunch, thinking there's no way. And they said, okay. His publicist was Kim Yorio. And I look at the calendar, and I'm not really that religious or anything.
Right.
It's Yom Kippur, the Jewish day of fasting.
Yes.
Okay? And so I start calling rabbis.
Right.
Look, the world's greatest chef, Ferran Adrià, is the world's greatest chef.
So you're calling to get a pardon?
I was told to say, can I fast the day after? Before the rabbis, you know, they love this kind of question, religious people.
Yeah, they're like, well, hold on, are you recording me while you're asking this question?
No, but they were all like, it's between you and God.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, oh, shit.
Oh, so
you
pushed it off.
And so I thought it was a test. I don't even fast every year, but that day I was going to fast. So what I did was they came. And, you know, I was working in that. I was sort of taking notes, but I didn't eat it until they finished at about 2 o'clock. I waited until about 6 and ate everything cold.
Okay.
Now, this wasn't like, he didn't prepare the, you know, whatever he called techno-emotional cuisine, as he calls it.
Techno-emotional.
That's what he calls it,
That's a good term.
It is.
Yeah,
it's like better than molecular gastronomy.
Yeah, I like that much better.
But, you know, we went shopping around Chinatown, Lower East Side. They found what they found. And, of course, I was also, Jose still gives me shit because I was like, who's this guy? I wanted to write about Ferran Adrià. I don't want this sous chef guy who was Jose Andres.
Oh.
So anyway, they made a really nice meal. The video is up on the Times site if anybody wants to watch it. But where am I going with
I'm
all
gonna
this?
Go watch it.
What else
That's
should I
funny.
Ask you about? What
the
else
baby
do you want to
likes
talk
his
about?
Cookbook.
Yes.
Well, they're beautiful books, you know.
We have an 18-month-old that likes to go into his cookbooks. She pulls them out, and that's the one she always pulls out.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. She always pulls
them
out.
They're on the bottom shelf because they're so heavy, so that's part of it. But they're also the new version, the new set, the neon green one. You know, so kind of it looks attractive. Plus, I mean, the food in there is beautiful.
She likes to flip the pages and say, mmm.
Well, that's what I'm asking about, though. Like, techno-emotional. Like, Volt, you and Michael sort of got known for was cakes in the microwave. And
right, no, and we still, like I said, we still do those things. We're not necessarily cakes in the microwave, but I mean, we do it, you know what I mean? And, you know, it's forward thinking.
Are you an artist?
I don't call food, that's like this one conversation I kind of never even want to really get into.
It's good,
like
let's get into
art.
It.
It's like, this food is art, and it's like, you know, there's some aspects that you can consider, okay, fine. Like, if you want to, you know, some chefs and some, okay, if I plate a dish, sometimes it only looks good if I plate it. Yeah, it sounds really, I don't know how to say it, but, you know.
Hoity-toity.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, as you're training cooks and other chefs to plate your food, sometimes they don't always see it the same way that you do. And so that part of it, I don't call it art, but I definitely call it there's an emotional connection between me and the plate and the guests in the diner and what that's going to be like. And so, art is different. I mean, it's creative, yes, don't get me wrong. It's creative expression, but I don't call it art because it's gone. I mean, you know, it's gone after they eat it.
So what?
Yeah.
The Buddhist monks make a sand mandala.
Right.
And as soon as they're done, they destroy it and they save the sand. There's something holy there.
True.
And just the sand.
Yeah, I don't look at it that way. I mean, I look at it also as an experience that's bigger than just the food, too. I mean, there's a hospitality aspect.
Right.
And there's also the experience in a room and everything
else. Okay, so that's like a Broadway theater.
You curate that, yes.
There's choices. Everything's a choice.
True. There's argument towards it, trust me. But, you know, not all of my food is artful. And the great thing is I do have different concepts that span many different experiences of food. I have a sandwich shop. I'm not a sandwich artist. You know what I mean? But it's, you know, there's something great to making a really good sandwich, you know? I mean, there's something about that if you pay attention to the details. But then it's just being a technician in the idea of making a sandwich and being precise about it. It's a good manufacturer.
But people know.
Not a good artist.
But you're part of the advertising for any of your restaurants. They know you, right? So they think there's a sensibility that you're bringing even to family meal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and well, they want to know that the experience is going to be, you know, better than they're going to get at that check average, and that's what I want to provide. You know, so there's a lot of thought that goes into our fried chicken. You know what I mean? I don't call my fried chicken an expression.
You sous vide it?
No.
I don't believe in that.
No, I don't either.
You sous vide anything?
No, we pressure fry though.
Okay.
So, and there's definitely an investment into how we're doing
it. A bag.
It is. No, I do some things under vacuum, but only when it makes sense. Like, not everything goes into a bag.
I don't like how Lawrence's fried chicken.
Hey, look, there was. I haven't had it yet. I haven't had it yet. So there certainly has its place in that. I'm glad we're introduced to the tool. Like, I like using it for compression, you know, where you're infusing ingredients into others, and you can use the vacuum for that. Cooking in it, you know, if you're trying to cook things precisely, it has its purpose. But not everything, you know. I don't take loin cuts and do that anymore. Like, I'm going back to more traditional ways of cooking. You know, but that we had to do that to understand it, though, too. We had to go through that time period, which is good. Like, I look at it as, like, all of these newer tools are just a part of our bag now. We just have more things to grab at to make our food
better.
More
like a scientist.
Less like a scientist.
What's your favorite dish at any of his restaurants?
Oh, gosh. Probably the fried chicken. So we go there. Oh, well, actually, no. The kitchen pickles that are with the fried chicken are my favorite.
Yeah.
They're really good.
You like the pickles.
They're so good.
But are they as good without the fried chicken?
I don't think so.
It's the experience.
It's almost like a wine.
The fried chicken is really, really delicious. Yeah. And crispy, and the kids love it. And so we go there.
We spend a lot of time. We brine it in roasted chicken stock and pickle brine. We brine for 12 hours.
Oh, I like that.
It goes into a dusting of very simply of cornmeal, little starch, and just AP flour and some seasoning. And then we let it sit for at least 45 minutes until the starches start to hydrate start to create this, you know, sticky sort of crust on the outside. And then it gets re-dredged and then fried in a pressure fryer at 315 for 11 and a half minutes. And it's beautiful.
See, that's
fried
not
chicken.
A fair question, because I don't get to all the restaurants all the time because I have three kids. Some of them are, you know.
Yeah. Now, at home, I did put the fried chicken recipe in there. It's in the book. Obviously, you're not pressure frying it, but all of the other steps are there. The brine is there, all of those pieces. You know, so it's as close as you can get. You know,
is it the same pickle brine that the pickles served with it are in?
Yeah, so we use some, but we make different pickles, but it's basically our dill pickle brine. So, it's, you know, we do pickled radishes, carrots, whatever's in season
there,
too.
Green beans, cauliflower.
It's more
all
seasonal.
All of it's kind of there right on the
seasonal side. Offering, you know, pickle plate.
Oh, and the sauces. All the sauces.
Yeah, we make our own.
So
yeah,
good.
Make our own hot sauce using peppers I get from a guy who has a farm about 5 miles from Cole. called Big White Barn.
So what
whoever does is pepper fields a lot, and so it's like, Brian, what do I do with shit tons of peppers? And I'm like, just give it to me, I'll take care of it. You know,
so what are the sort of the local treats that you can get in that area that you can't elsewhere?
Pawpaws. Pawpaws are probably the biggest.
Pawpaws?
Pawpaws. You ever hear pawpaws?
I've heard it, but I have no idea what it is.
So pawpaws are this tree fruit that grows near like the Sea Oak Canal. It's a tropical flavor. It's very unique. It almost tastes, it has the texture of banana, but it's shaped like a seed pod, and it has, you know, typically a pretty large hard seed in the center, and there's not a lot of flesh. Kind of looks like a mango.
Right.
It's like a small kidney shaped mango. And it's typically used in like custards and stuff like that. We use it a lot in at Bullock right now. And it's there's actually some people that are cultivating them now. There's a farm in Westminster, which is outside Baltimore. They have about 1,000 trees, you know, so we can actually get them kind of on a regular basis. And they've been you know, crossed in order to, you know, reduce the seed size, which is great. Gives us more usable. But that's definitely an ingredient that's.
And what are you still
in that area? And there's crab. I mean,
crab. Yes.
That's the thing. It's like, you know, we have more than just crab. You know what I mean? So the great thing about being in that region, you know, just like up here in the Hudson Valley too, which is cool, there's a long growing season. You know, there really is. I mean, here probably less than mid-Atlantic. I mean, down there, you know, we have, you know, 9 months out of the year we got stuff in the field. People don't really realize
you can,
that.
You can consider Southern Virginia part of your...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chesapeake watershed. That's right. How I look at it. I mean, there's Swiss jar, spinach, and stuff like that in the fields now. Well, not now, but I'm thinking fall.
Yeah,
in the fall.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been talking also to a lot of a farmer recently, and this is, you know, something in the future, about winterizing crops in the field. You know, we're talking about carrots and turnips and stuff like that. I want to experiment with that, and leave it in, and then pull it when we need it. So that's my next goal. So we're harvesting. If it freezes, though, they can still till it out, because these are crops that are growing close to the ground. So, I mean, yeah, it's a lot of work. But we get thaw season, you know, there's times of the year where the ground softens. If we can go and grab those ingredients then, we can get it. Because it's only talking about 6 inches down, you know.
Interesting.
So we'll see. It's a future thing. We'll see. Something we're working on for this year. This year into next. So
that's what's nice, too, is that you have people that are willing to grow things for you.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that means anything. It just could be, you know, I'm just interested in trying that. You know, and so I got some people buying into the idea.
But I mean, do you think farmers are doing it just
for like
economic?
A small acre, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
We're not playing with a lot of stuff. But
they're doing it because they enjoy it too.
Yeah, because
right?
They want to see little... us use the produce, and they want to understand it. Like, I have a couple of passionate people that want like to see their food on the plate.
Right.
And so when you get that connection, it's like, okay, well, what can we do? We start talking about all this crazy stuff, you know? It's like, not crazy, but we just talk about, you know, getting stuff specific to the restaurant and sustaining us a little bit longer than, you know, typical growing seasons. You know, rotational crop programs. That way, we always have, you know, crops on the way in the door.
What are you
keeping
still
yields down?
What are you still flying in from South America?
South America
or wherever? Jet planes. What's the
right
coming
now,
by jet planes?
I mean, not so much. I would say right now. I mean, I know there is limes.
Trim.
Limes.
All right,
you know,
limes.
This time of year, no, shrimp is, you know, I'm not getting, because we're using some flash frozen stuff too. Not too much, really. I mean, so I know there is. I mean, I gotta kind of go back there and think about what it
You've
is.
You've got six restaurants.
You know, I'm trying to reduce that though as much as possible. My goal of Bolt, actually, and this is something I haven't put out there yet, my goal of Bolt, you know, hopefully by the 7th year anniversary, which is this August, or it's actually July 25th, I want to cook only in the Chesapeake watershed. And it's just because it's going to be a challenge. Like, I want to put a new challenge to Bolt, 7 years old. It's like, okay, well, what can we do to pressure ourselves? You know, because then that means in cocktails, I can't use limes and lemons. You know, I can't use, you know, produce... Absolutely not out of season. The only thing that worries me is obviously getting into the winter, and that's why I already started to think about getting some farmers along this idea of possibly winterizing crop. That way I have it. I don't even know what that means yet. You know, certainly we can root cellar, we can do all of those things, and trust me, I can get beets right now from Pennsylvania. But you know, because people do some cellaring there. But I can't just serve beets, you know what I mean? Like, I got to serve more than that. So, you know, we're definitely starting to plan towards that. And so, I'm really talking about it.
Okay, let me ask you two more things. And
we're working on menu soon. So.
I got to go catch a bus to go skiing, but... let me ask you about my pet peeve. How loud is the music in your restaurants? And do you think about it? And are you aware of the fact that the workers want it louder than the patrons want it?
Yes, and it's true. We keep a close eye on our music. The thing is, what I don't like is that we use Pandora boxes a lot in some of the restaurants, some of the newer restaurants, and sometimes music comes on I don't want to listen to. So actually, I keep it low. Like, I keep it at a talking level. I don't like loud music in the restaurant. I like loud music in my car when I'm driving home after shift, but not in a restaurant. So I want to be able to have a conversation. So it's good. I mean, it's background music. And also, everybody uses music with vocals now, which you didn't do 10 years ago.
Yes.
And so having it loud, it's disruptive.
It's not, I know.
It's disruptive, you know.
You want to when you go hyper-local on Volt.
Oh, am I going to do that with the music,
too?
Go no music.
There's a new McNally's new places here is no music.
You know, I'm on a
crusade.
Yeah, you're on a crusade to take music out of restaurants.
Well, it's not just take music out of restaurants. It's called eating and having conversation.
Yeah,
it's a crazy thing.
You know, there's and I don't know.
The food critic in our town.
There's been thoughts about running static, low levels of static. You have to create some kind of noise where you don't.
If you're in California,
if you're in
Berkeley,
you can't hear it though.
There's a guy who apparently he was the sound guy for Fish, and he's opened a restaurant, a Mexican restaurant in Berkeley, and each table has its own specific sound.
And
He is somehow wired it so it goes up and down based on your sound the table, and you can, the acoustics, you can talk, and there's music.
Okay, well, that's different.
Hired the sound guy from Fish.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
All right, what restaurant would you open if you could, if money was no object, and you weren't, not just a lot of money, but if you weren't worried about failing?
I wasn't worried about failing. What restaurant would I open? I had this conversation earlier, actually, today. I mean, I know it's cliche to, like,
damn
have this
it.
Whole...
I asked it.
No, but I didn't have it with anybody that... No, I didn't have it with anybody who...
Egg recording you?
Recorded it. And so, and actually, we just had the conversation. So it was just me and her.
Okay, okay.
And, you know, I would want to do something that... I'll tell you what it is. I would want to wake up in my underwear and go downstairs in my house.
Oh, yeah. I know where you're
going. And start doing my prep work while my kids are running around the house and getting them off to the bus, and I would just invite people over for dinner in my house.
He's talked about that a lot, actually.
You know, why not? I mean, because the experience as a chef to me is, you know, there's the restaurant experience, but also there's a part of me where I feel like I'm inviting somebody in my home, so why not do it? But then I started thinking, I was like, damn, that would suck to have people in your house every day. But I think part of it would be really cool. So I'd have to have, obviously, I'd have to have some private space, and we'd have to have this. It'd be like taking the White House tour, and you're not allowed to go in those rooms. You know what I mean?
Yeah, my dentist had, the office attached to the house.
Okay,
well,
that's...
you talked about it. He talked about it on the farm.
You just said something I never considered, and thank you very much for that.
Oh.
Dental practices in people's houses. Wow, why not?
What?
There's people that, why not have a restaurant? Why not have a restaurant in your house?
You talked about it, though, and you said on a farm, and then we'd have a separate house
connected. I mean, I would like to have, space. So I'd like to have,
Your own kitchen.
That's where I didn't want it to sound cliche. Because everybody has these farm restaurants now, which is cool, and I get that, and I
want
to,
I want goats.
Right. And so I would like to have, obviously, the eggs are there, and, I don't
everything
want people
would be
sleeping.
Right there.
And so
no, not
it's
have
cool.
people sleeping there.
Right, I don't want people sleeping over, but it would be. I would want some of their product.
Unless they're very drunk and it's unsafe for them to drive.
That's true.
Yeah, I would want some of the people, some of the product to come from the place. I would want to have a hand in that, and I would want people to come to my house and have dinner at my house. And I would want it to be like you would come in, and basically how you would if you're having a dinner party. You come in, have hors d'oeuvres, have some sparkling, kind of get things started, and then go into service. And I wouldn't have servers there. I would have people working with me, obviously, because I'm not going to do it all myself, and I don't like doing dishes.
Oh, no. That's why I learned to cook.
Right.
Literally.
That's why I cook.
My mom was willing
to
do the
so it could be in my future.
Instead of cooking. I was 11. All right. This is a wonderful interview. Thank you.
Absolutely.
It's New Books and Food. I'm Alan. That's Brian. Bye.
This is New Books in Food, part of the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com, where there are interviews with authors on every subject you can imagine. It's a great site. Check it out to find recipes and other material related to what we talked about today. Check out cookbooks.about.com, the about.com website for which I am the cookbooks and food writing expert. My website is allensalkin.com, A-L-L-E-N, S like Sam, A-L-K-I-N. All my social media is Alan Salkin also. Instagram, Facebook is facebook.com/Salkin. Twitter is Alan Salkin. I think you can find me. Guess what? My name's Alan Salkin. Thanks for listening.